Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Math, a channel of the New Books Network. Our guest today is Alexander Dragunov, author of Mathematical Tools for Real-World Application. Alexander says everyone calls him Sasha, so I will too. I've never read a book like this. It's a book about how engineers and scientists see math, and I found it fascinating. What intrigued me about this book was not that it just presents and solves a bunch of interesting problems. It shows how scientists and engineers differ in their approach to problem solving from mathematicians. Shame on me, but as a mathematician, I've always been a little uncomfortable with the way engineers and scientists use mathematics. I wish I'd seen this book when I was in college. I'd have done a lot better in my physics courses. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Jim.
Sasha, what's your background and how did it motivate you to write this book?
I grew up in Kyiv, Ukraine, which was at the time, it was still a part of the Soviet Union. So, of course, as you know, I cannot avoid stating that, but today Ukraine is an independent country, but is brutally attacked by Russia, which seemingly wants to go back to that Soviet Union. And I was there in the 70s. I was very lucky with my high school. We had great teachers in physics and math. I want to mention one of them. Her name is Vera Rosenberg. I recently learned from a friend that she now lives in New York. I got her number, I called her, and she said that, Sasha, I remember you. You were younger than your peers. And I was, indeed, but I became her student 50 years ago, in 1972. And I was told by my friends that she remembers all of her students.
Wow.
Yes.
I remember a few good ones.
Okay. I went to major in theoretical physics in Kyiv University. And there it was considered cool to do analytical solutions on paper and to use computers as little as possible. First of all, of course, computers were primitive, but also it was kind of a difference between artisanal work, handmade product, and something that is made by a machine. And of course, now we have little limitations on the computer power, but I think analysis is still quite important. And computers do produce numbers and plots, but we still need to understand what that means. And that is part of my motivation for writing this book.
Yeah, you know, the background of this book consists of six important mathematical tools for solving those nasty real-world problems. First of all, what is it that makes real-world problems nastier than the ones you see in a standard math book?
So I think real-world problems are nastier in a sense that they're messier. Usually there are many factors different present. There are many phenomena everything is coupled. And in applications, it's very difficult to come up with a clean, isolated problem. Many such problems have already been solved. And take, for example, take a computation of a satellite orbit. So we know that Isaac Newton solved this problem for two spherical bodies or two point masses. But to launch a satellite today, we need to do much better than that. It's no longer an elliptical orbit because Earth is not spherical. Distribution of mass in the Earth is not uniform. There is gravity from Sun, Moon, and other planets, such Jupiter primarily. There is atmospheric drag from this very thin plasma that where a satellite is in, and other phenomena. That is what are real-world applications. And one more thing that I want to say is that math textbooks for high schools are largely driven today by standardized tests. And such tests, they must have a lot of problems. They cannot have two or three problems to solve for a test, because then the results of a test would not be statistically significant. And that's why they have dozens of problems on a test, but then solution of each problem must be really short and not nasty. And students get used to that. And then that student goes to college, where things are somewhat different, and then she goes to either grad school or to work, and she gets a problem that requires 3 months to solve, and that's a very different thing. So that is complete change, and for a messy problem, it's easier to make a mistake, so one has to be on guard at all times, and you have to know where you're going, and you have to use a different set of tools, and that's what I was trying to do.
You know, one of the things that you say at the start of the book is that a real-world problem usually does not have a single number as an answer, and there are a lot of trade-offs. Could you give an example of what you mean by this?
Yes. So I feel the goal is rarely a number as such, because number is an abstract thing, and we have other goals, which are usually non-numerical. A concrete goal, the goal may be like a working device or a functioning system, or maybe we need to make a conclusion whether a new drug works from results of a clinical trial and so forth. So in all these examples, there are different parameters and they can be viewed as knobs to turn and levers to pull. And there is a space of parameters that should be explored. And for example, take someone who is designing a cellular network, and the ultimate goal is to achieve a good coverage at some reasonable cost. So there is a choice between fewer towers, cell towers and higher signal power at each, or more towers and lower power. There is height of the tower, terrain can be different, it can be urban or rural or things in between. And there is other choices that must be made, such as structure of the signal and antenna placement. And that means that a model for such a system should have all these parameters, and this space of parameters should be explored.
You know, don't see that in math books. there is a feature of this book that I found very attractive. The first is that although you have sections in the back devoted to solving the problems you study, the book is not so much about solving problems as it is to examining whether solutions or proposed solutions are reasonable. You also pay a great deal of attention to extracting the most mileage from a solution to a problem. These really are real-world applications, and this book is the first one I've seen that spends so much time on this, and I think it's really important.
I'm trying to use simpler problems there in the book, not as complicated as, designing a cellular network, but using various tools to a particular problem to explore it from different angles.
Yeah, let's look at the six important tools you study one by one. The first is dimensional analysis, which you never see in a math book, although I do recall one of my physics books mentioning it right off the bat. Exactly what is dimensional analysis?
So, as you know, that many quantities are measured in some kind of units. Distance may be measured in meters or light years, and time in seconds, and the revenue of a company in dollars, and so forth. And the basic thing is that units must be consistent in each equation. Another thing which is important, and some people are not aware of this, that both the argument and the value of any transcendental function must be dimensionless. So it is, must not be measured in any units. And that is true, for example, for trigonometric functions, for exponents, and all the special functions like Bessel functions or the gamma functions, so on. And of course, the question is why units must be consistent. I think one, you know, typical explanation is that units are our arbitrary choice, and if we change units, the results should scale in a particular way for all equations, all the results. And if you consider a sum of a distance and a time where things are measured in different units, they would not scale. And that's why units must be important, must be consistent.
You know, my impression is that dimensional analysis is often used as a check to see if a solution is reasonable. It seems to me that this will catch gross errors such as the one you mentioned. Are you measuring, are you adding distance and time? But maybe it doesn't catch the lesser ones so well.
Yes, of course, no tool is universal. A lot of errors that are not caught by dimensional analysis, but still it should be a habit, almost like brushing teeth in the morning. And I have to say that I've seen highly qualified people whom I deeply respect who failed to check units and were getting a wrong formula as a result of that. So it has to be done.
Yeah.
It's not difficult to do.
No, it certainly isn't. But I can recall back in, I think it was the 90s, that the Americans and the Europeans were measuring in different units, and they hadn't really, one was measuring in English units and one was measuring in metric units, and as a result, they lost a $200 million satellite.
That's correct. Yeah. It was Mars orbiter that went not to Mars, but elsewhere.
Yeah, just ridiculous. Anyway, what is a dimensionless variable and how are they used?
So a dimensionless variable is quite useful. It is a combination of two or more variables that does not have any units associated with it. And the simplest case is a ratio of two variables that have the same units. For example, speed is measured typically in meters per second, but the ratio of, say, like my driving speed or walking speed to the speed of light is dimensionless, right?
Yeah.
And so they are used in two ways primarily. First, if we consider, again, exploring the space of parameters, sometimes there are many parameters to deal with, three, four, five, 10 parameters. And it's quite difficult to understand what's going on because of many, many different facets in the problem. And so if you combine these parameters in dimensionless combinations, you will almost always see that there are fewer variables to deal with. And second is very important, is to determine if a variable is large or small. So if I'm looking at my walking speed, in millimeters per second, it has a large numerical value, and in kilometers per second, it's small. So there is no way to determine whether it's large or small. But if you look at its ratio to, say, speed of light, it's small. And that means that...
Well, so is practically everything.
Yeah, so you don't have to use relativistic theory to analyze that, right? So
yeah. You know, one of the things that I like about each of the chapters in your book that analyze the various different tools, and we'll get on to some of the others in a moment, is at the start of the chapter, you have an anecdote as to why this particular tool is important. And at the end of each chapter, you have a nice summary of what you consider the important takeaways. I liked both of these.
I was trying to, first of all, to make sure that readers know that something is important, and these anecdotes are put them in a position to appreciate that tool that will be introduced in that particular chapter.
Yeah, some of the anecdotes were very attractive, and I enjoyed reading them. Anyway, the next tool you look at is limiting case analysis. This is a tool which is useful for both mathematical and practical problems. You spend a lot of time looking at limiting cases for a quadratic equation. What are some practical problems for which this is important?
So limiting cases, I think they are very useful. And I just want to tell like an old joke about a theoretical physicist who is hired by a company making furniture. And they ask him to compute the stability of a regular table with four legs. And very quickly, he brings results for a table with one leg and for a table with the infinite number of legs. And then he starts working on the stability of a table with an arbitrary number of legs attached to the table in arbitrary way. And that tells you the way to use limiting cases. So if you have a difficult problem, one way to approach it is to solve a simpler problem first, and often that is a problem where one of the parameters has some kind of special value. It may be very small or very large or pi over 2 or something like this. Then you do that, and then you start to work on the main problem. But first of all, you already have appreciation for where you are going. Second, when you are solving the main problem, you can refer back to the limiting case and see whether it's consistent with that limiting case and whether everything is going right.
Yeah, that's a nice point that you can check by looking at the limiting cases. You know, earlier you discussed cellular networks as to what you were doing on the ground, but what problems arise when engineers are working out how to place satellites for maximum utility?
Well, there are many problems, where you place that satellite or a constellation, and how do you design, for example, antennas for that satellite or any kind of communication equipment. If you're talking about limiting cases, what comes to mind is that you may try to cover as much space on the surface of Earth as possible, and a GPS satellite is an example of that. Each GPS satellite covers approximately almost half of the globe. On the other hand, telecommunication satellites, they want to maximize power at a particular user, so they have a very narrow beam that targets a particular user, each particular user. And so these are different kind of...
I see. Those are both limiting cases.
Yeah.
You know, when you introduce the idea of symmetry, you used a discussion about Newton's falling apple. I just absolutely love this, and I think the audience would appreciate it as well.
Yes, what Newton could have thought when he saw that apple falling. So he saw that it is moving in the direction to the center of the Earth, right? And that is true whether it falls in the suburb of London or in America or in Paris or Beijing. And so if you assume that both the apple and the Earth are spherical, that direction is special because it's the axis of symmetry for this two spheres. And if the apple went in any other direction, it would create a problem. For example, consider a situation when the apple goes not exactly downward, but somewhat eastward. And then there would be a question, why is it going eastward and not westward? Because this is a completely equivalent directions. Why would it choose one of them? But for the direction exactly downward, there is no symmetric counterpart. And so that question never comes up. And so this is an example of how another key thought is that if the apple falls to Earth, the Earth also falls to the apple, because these two bodies, they are not different in principle, right? They have different sizes.
The attraction is mutual, right?
Yeah. And I also want to give another example, which I like. There was this well-known theoretical physicist. His name was Arkady Migdal. And many years ago, I heard an interview with him, and he was telling a story. So he was in the mountains, sitting next to a young couple. And the woman asked her friend, why is the sky so blue? And as you know, in the mountains, the sky is more deep blue than at the sea level. And the young man said, this is because the light scattering is proportional to the third power of frequency. And Migdal intervened in this. He couldn't tolerate that, of course, and he intervened in this conversation and said, young man, light scattering is a reversible process, and therefore it can only be proportional to an even power of frequency. In this case, the fourth. And this is a great example of how asymmetry with respect to the direction of the time axis works. And Migdal, of course, understood that. But we can learn also how to use symmetry to our advantage to see whether things look right or not.
Well, symmetry, I'm not so familiar with symmetry in engineering. Of course, I'm familiar with symmetry in mathematics. We use it a lot. But also you see it in physics. And I just sort of like to just temporarily detour into this for a moment. One is the idea of symmetry occurs in Einstein's assumption of isotropy for the theory of relativity, that the universe looks the same no matter where you are.
Yes, this is symmetry towards, transitions and rotations is absolutely fundamental in physics. Of course, it's what physics is largely based on. By the way, it's also connected with conservation laws. But I want to mention that symmetry cannot be taken for granted always. So, for example, the left-right symmetry doesn't always hold. People have assumed that if you see a system, one system that is a mirror image of another system, it would behave the same way, but a mirror image of that behavior. But that's not true. There are some exotic situations when a mirror image process is different from another one. And people did get a Nobel Prize for this sometimes in the 50s.
Yeah, I remember. I think they got it back when I was first starting out as a student back in the 50s. And that was something that always sort of intrigued me. And I read things about it, but I never really studied it, about how the idea of swapping variables induced a symmetry. For instance, they talk about in physics, they talk about things such as charge parity, symmetry, and stuff like that. And I thought this was extremely interesting that the universe worked that this way, and it made some sort of sense to me. But my physics courses, the physics courses that I took were at the elementary level, and I realized pretty quickly that I was more suited for mathematics than physics or engineering. So I didn't get into this. But every so often I read in articles about people talking about various symmetry violations and what impact they have on the universe. And I think that's, I think if physicists think that's an important idea, they're the ones who know best.
Yeah, and that's true. And I think it's not just physics. So for example, you mentioned swapping variables. This can be a purely mathematical thing, or it can be useful in economics or data analysis and what have you. So for example, like a very simple example, if you have two variables that play the same role and they can be swapped in some equations, they also can be swapped and leave equations invariant in all other equations for that system. So for example, take a sine function of x plus y, a sine of a sum. And you can swap X and Y, of course, and the result will be the same. But that also means that the identity for the sign of a sum must have the same property, right? So the identity is sine of X plus Y is equal to sine X cosine Y plus cosine X sine Y, and it does have the same property. So this is another tool that can be used to check your results. This is a tool that can be used to predict what form a solution should have, in rough terms, of course. And take a number of ways, for example, to select 7 objects from a set of 10 objects. And there is a formula that is given by the binomial coefficient. But if you take 7 objects out of 10, you leave 3 objects on the table. And that means that the number of ways to take 7 objects from a set must be the same as the number of ways to take 3 objects. And binomial coefficients do have that property, of course. So it's not just in physics, it's a very common property that we should learn how to recognize and use to our advantage.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I remember thinking about that in basketball, because in basketball, a team consists of 12 people, but only 5 are on the floor at any time. And so one of the standard questions one have is how many different teams can be, is it possible to put on the floor? But you can also look at it as the number of people who are sitting on the bench at the same time, because when you take 5 people and put them on the floor, 7 are sitting on the bench. The number of bench sitting teams must be the same as the number of playing teams.
Exactly.
Yep. You know, you discuss a problem which fascinated me, the syrup blending problem. Exactly what is it, and how does symmetry apply?
So it's not a very practical problem, but I thought it is a good illustration of what I was trying to present in the book. So say you have 2 or 3 sugar syrups, solution of sugar in water, and they have known masses and concentrations of sugar. And the question is, what would be the concentration of sugar if you mix them together? So one symmetry is quite obvious. If you swap in your equations syrup 1 and syrup 2, the result will be the same. That is natural. The second symmetry deals with the way we can blend 3 syrups. And there are 2 ways to do that. One is we just put 3 of them in a bowl and mix them. Another is to do it in 2 stages. We blend syrups 1 and 2, and then that mix we blend with syrup 3. And obviously the result, the final result, the concentration of the final mix should be the same, because it doesn't matter how you do that. But equations look somewhat different if you model this process, right?
Yeah,
but they, of course, they have to produce the same
answer,
the same result, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the third symmetry deals with the concentration of water in each syrup, because we just chose to compute concentration of sugar, but this is one ingredient. The same should be true for the other ingredient, which is water, and results should be invariant where you kind of
I love this problem because there were so many different symmetries that you never think of, because normally you just grind out the answer, but that's just really cute. You know, you also, you discussed satellite coverage in conjunction with limiting case analysis, but it also shows up in the symmetry section. How is symmetry used in this problem?
So in that problem, we consider a satellite that transmits a signal in a conical beam directly downward, and that beam on the Earth's surface, it covers a round spot. And so the question is, what is the radius of that spot? And if you think about it, because of symmetry, and this is kind of explained in the book, the radius of the spot as a function of the angle in the beam cone must be either an even or an odd function, depending on how that radius is measured, in which direction it is measured. But it cannot be a function that is neither odd nor even. And this is one way to check if the solution is right. And this is kind of like that example from Arkady Migdal, which also dealt with an even function, essentially.
The next tool you investigate is scaling. What is the difference between linear scaling, power law scaling, and exponential scaling?
So scaling is what happens if a parameter is multiplied by a constant factor. And sometimes we know what happens with the system or with equations. For example, if you ride a bike on a level path with no hills, your effort is mostly to overcome the force of the air drag, and that scaling is quadratic with respect to velocity. And that means that if you ride at twice the speed, the air drag quadruples. And this is probably familiar to many listeners. It's much difficult to increase speed. That kind of ripples through all these equations, and it is quite important in practice, right? And geese fly in V formation for that reason. They conserve energy, except for the one goes in the front. And often there are multiple scaling behaviors, and they compete with each other. For example, a linear and quadratic one, and one scaling can completely dominate the other one. And that can be used to simplify the problem, because we can neglect one of the effects if it is quite small, right?
Yes.
And then there is exponential scaling, and we know that exponential growth always eventually wins over a power law. No matter what is the power law, no matter what is the exponential growth, it wins eventually, if it is maintained, of course. And this is what financial people mean when they talk about the power of compound interest.
One of the first things in astronomy that I found fascinating was something called Olber's paradox, which I think is almost 200 years old. And what exactly is it, and how does it relate to scaling?
Yeah, I try to use Olber's paradox to show how different scalings work together. And the paradox goes like this. So suppose our universe is infinite and has infinite number of stars, and they are on average statistically kind of more or less uniformly spread in the universe. So the intensity of light from each individual star scales with the distance from that star as 1 over distance squared. But the number of stars that emit light to us that we can see from a particular distance also scales, and it increases as a power law, right? And so if you believe that model, if you combine these two scalings, the whole intensity of light from all the stars in the universe doesn't converge if you look it over distance,
Yeah, infinity. Each shell at a constant radius should contribute the same amount of light.
Yeah, and so we should see an infinitely bright sky day or night. And that, of course, doesn't happen, so something must be wrong here, and we can point to a couple of things that make this paradox not applicable to real life. And maybe the universe is not infinite, maybe it came to be a finite time ago, and so we only can see stars from limited distance, which are at some limited distance and so on.
Yeah, I think it's a lovely example. The next tool that you discuss is order of magnitude estimates, and it seems like that's more of a scientific tool or an engineering tool than a mathematical one. But I like your lead-off example of Fermi estimating the strength of the first atomic bomb explosion.
Yeah, I agree that it is more a scientific or engineering tool, used less in mathematics. And about that anecdote, Fermi was present at the first atmospheric test of the atomic bomb. A group of people were standing at some distance from the blast, which was deemed safe, and he was dropping tiny pieces of paper on the ground. And he observed how these pieces of paper were falling. And when the blast wave hit their site, these pieces of paper were blown away by a few feet. And from that observation, from the distance which these pieces of paper traveled, he was able to roughly estimate the power of the explosion in kilotons. And later that estimate was confirmed. It was a rough estimate, but it was correct by the order of magnitude.
You know, I think Fermi was very well known for being able to make back-of-the-envelope calculations that were remarkably accurate.
Yeah.
Yep. What are coupling effects, and how do they impact order of magnitude estimates?
So there are multiple competing effects usually in any application. Estimating a satellite orbit, and it's quite complicated in real life. We have to account... Should we account for the gravity from moon or tides in the ocean or atmospheric drag, and where we draw the line? So we have to estimate roughly each effect and decide that this effect, particular effect, is important. Say gravity from moon and tides are important, but pressure from the solar wind is not. But in addition, all these effects are coupled. So the combined effect of the tides and say atmospheric drag or any combination of the two is not just the sum of these effects really, but if you estimate each of them and draw the line somewhere, some of them can be neglected. So we cannot account for everything, but we have to decide what is important and what is not.
You know, one really practical use of order of magnitude estimates sort of surprised me when I saw it in your book. It's in estimating mortgage payments. And since I'm willing to bet that the majority of our listeners have mortgage payments or are considering mortgage payments, I'm guessing most of our listeners would be interested in this.
Yeah, I can brag a little. When we were buying our first home, I impressed the loan officer by quickly estimating mortgage payments without using a specialized financial calculator. I used a regular calculator, and I even corrected his mistake because he punched numbers incorrectly. But in general, finance has a lot to do with rough estimates, because when we start a project or just consider a budget, it is quite important to see what are major important things and which are minor things, which are less important, which can be almost ignored, right? So we don't have to sweat over the small stuff.
Yep, absolutely. And I remember I spent some of my time as a stock option trader, and there's a very well-known formula, the Black-Scholes formula, which gives you the estimate, which gives you an estimate of the value of a stock option in terms of five different variables. But some of the variables, like the current interest rate, can be neglected. And so you learn to make order of magnitude estimates unless you have something available to compute this. And back in the day, you just didn't. So it's, you know, being able to produce order of magnitude estimates is extremely useful. And it's a skill that I think should be taught, you know, that you can learn, you know, that you can teach a child, because one of the things that you can do is teach them how to make approximations. They go to the store with their mother. How much, you know, what's the bill going to be? Things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
And the last tool that you discuss is successive approximations. And again, you lead off with a lovely example. How did this tool enable 19th century astronomers to deduce the location of the planet Neptune?
So this is a classic story. It's well known. In the beginning of the 19th century, astronomers had data on the orbit of Uranus, which was the last known planet at the time. But then it turns out that the data could not be explained by the gravity from the Sun and from the other planets. And two mathematicians, not sure how to pronounce the name, Urbain Le Verrier, I guess, and John Couch Adams, independently of each other, they had a hypothesis that the irregularities in that orbit were due to another yet unknown planet. And so they decided to check whether such planet, where such planet might be located. This was before computers were available, of course. Calculation was very tricky, but they predicted the location of that planet, the orbit, and astronomers pointed telescopes to the region predicted by the theory, and sure enough, there was a planet that they called Neptune. But what is important is that there is no nice closed-form solution for that problem, because at most we can do a two-body problem. There was a substantial progress in a three-body problem, but it was like eight bodies there, right? But the whole thing became possible only because they assumed that there was a small parameter, so that interaction between pairs of planets is small compared to the interaction with Sun. And this is how the method of successive approximation works. You leverage a small parameter. And of course, a small parameter must be dimensionless, as we talked about. So if you have one, it gives you a great tool to solve very tough problems.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that the universe manages to solve the three-body problem quite well just because it puts those planets there and they interact with each other and they go where the laws tell them, but we can't fit, you know, we have difficulty and have to approximate it because we can't find the exact solution that the universe has.
Yeah, of course, this is like an analog computer, not a digital computer, but an analog one.
Right? Yeah, very, very true. You've sort of given us a hint as to why approximations are so important in real-world problems, but do you have any favorite examples other than, for instance, the one involving Neptune in which successive approximations are important?
One approximation is If you turn on a GPS receiver, it has to assume some default position first. And in many cases, it assumes a default position in the center of the Earth. Even though, obviously, a signal cannot penetrate there, right? But then it uses these successive approximations, and it quickly converges to the exact position within a few iterations, and that happens every time. so it's quite tough.
And you just mentioned iteration. What is it, and how does it apply to the classic problem of the race between Achilles and the tortoise?
Listeners who studied computer science are often familiar with that, because you start from some initial guess and then repeat the calculations to approach a solution, and that's how many things are computed, like square root of 2 on a calculator. But in the book, I used the classic example of Achilles chasing a tortoise just to illustrate this, right? So there is this Zeno paradox, which says that Achilles can never reach the tortoise in a race. And if you're not familiar with that paradox, suppose that originally Achilles was behind the tortoise, separated from the tortoise by, say, 100 meters, right? And then tortoise runs 10 times slower than Achilles does. And so Achilles runs that distance, but the tortoise also moves by 10 meters. Then Achilles runs 10 meters, but the tortoise moves 1 meter, and so on. And Zeno, an ancient Greek philosopher, concluded that this requires infinitely many steps, and therefore Achilles should not be able to reach the tortoise. But of course, in reality, this whole series, it converges, so Achilles is fine, but this thinking of solving problem in an iterative way rather than at once is how iterations work. And they approach the correct result after some number of steps.
Yeah, you know, when I think of iteration as used in mathematics, you see that a lot of problems involving solutions of equations, finding roots of functions, that's one of them, or finding numerical solutions to differential equations, a lot of them are iterative processes, meaning that I think of it as the next step depends on where you were in the previous step and the process you take.
Right. And for example, regional Google algorithm, which is called PageRank, it was an iterative process. It was finding the largest eigenvalue of a very large sparse matrix using an iterative approach. And it made Google what it is now.
Wow. You know, a lot of the times people don't think that mathematics has application in the real world. They think of it as sort of abstract. And yes, they know that engineering and physics and a lot of, you know, that there are a lot of places that use mathematics, but they think of it sort of more as a tool than as something that's integral to with the way that the universe works. And I'm a believer that it's integral to the way the universe works. But I think one of the things that I really liked about your book is that, as I said, it made me more comfortable with the way scientists and engineers use mathematics, because they don't necessarily use it with the exactitude and precision that mathematics does, but they get stuff to work.
Yeah. Again, problems in mathematical textbooks are, I felt, they are different from real-world applications. There is a gap.
And, oh, you bet.
My goal was trying to fill that gap, yes.
You know, at the end of the book, you discuss two real-world problems that use some or all of the tools that you dictate in that book. And one of them just absolutely resonated with me, and I'm sure it's going to resonate with our listeners when we discuss it or when you discuss it. The first of your problems was how to minimize the probability that an airplane does not land on the intended runway. How does this occur, and how do the tools in your book help to prevent this?
So this problem is an example of a situation when you have random events that may be extremely rare, but also catastrophic. So it is an airplane crash, a powerful earthquake, and so on, right?
Yep.
And one of the lessons that were hard learned is that distribution, probability distribution for such events is not necessarily Gaussian. So the main hump of the distribution function quite often is close to Gaussian, but people overuse this, what is known as the central limit theorem, and they conclude that tails are also Gaussian, and tails converge much more slowly if you look at how it works. And so many people do not appreciate this. They estimate probability of such events, and they can conclude that it's negligible, but it is not. And we have to account for that. We have to design systems, safety-critical systems, in such a way that accounts for that. So the tools in my book help to get appreciation for how much things can be different from a Gaussian in that particular example. And I want to give an application that is important. Of course, this is now, you know, most people recognize that, and when designing, airplanes or nuclear power stations, they know that, fortunately.
Yeah, of the tools that you of the tools that you discuss in the book, there were six of them. Which do you find that? Which do you think are more valuable, and which do you think occur most frequently?
I think occurs most frequently is limiting case analysis, because almost every problem, you can use it for almost any problem. What is quite valuable is successive approximations, because it almost provided job security for generations of physicists and engineers.
Yes, and as someone who's spent some time early in my youth working for an engineering firm, I can appreciate that. Sasha, it's been a pleasure interviewing you, and I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. First, I suspect that there might be some people who will be interested in communicating with you. As I said, one of the things that I wish I'd done is I wish I'd had your book available when I was taking engineering and physics courses early in my career, because I know I would have done a lot better, because I just didn't think like that. I thought like a mathematician rather than a physicist or an engineer, and I think this book has helped you in that area. So how can listeners get in touch with you if they want to?
It's simple. Email works well for me, and my email is Sasha, which is S-A-S-H-A, then dot, my last name, Dragunov, at gmail.com. And I'll be very glad to hear from listeners of this podcast or from readers of the book.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've always been, it's not just you, but over the years I've had occasion to write people in academia who may have been, you know, who may have been more very well known, but didn't know who I was, and they were unfailingly polite. And I think that's one thing that members of the audience may not appreciate, is that if you write an academic, they're almost certain to write back, because A, they're not deluged with mail. They don't get fan mail like a rock star or an athlete. And usually when people write an academic, it concerns a problem that either interested the academic or something that may potentially interest them. So we're interested in getting emails. And the other thing that I'd like to ask you is if you have any interesting projects on the horizon that we might be interested in and might get to talk to you about at a future date.
So I just completed one project, and that was writing down solutions to all exercises in the book. So in case someone wants to teach a class based on this book, solutions to all the exercises are available.
That's good to know, but that's about this book. Have you got anything mind for the future?
Right. And originally, I wanted to write something for high school, but failed. It drifted towards a college level. But now I am still want to have a challenge and to write something for the high school level. And my next goal, hopefully, will be write a book that tells high school students what a proof is, how to do proofs. And there are some good books on this, but I think there is still a need for another one.
There are certainly a bunch of good books on it. I just finished interviewing someone on the history of proof, but I think that would be a wonderful contribution if you can make it at the high school level, because some of the proof techniques that mathematicians and mathematicians and physicists acquire usually require substantially more background and experience in doing them. And I know that when I took geometry long ago and far away, I'd found algebra and arithmetic very easy. And when it got to geometry and proofs, I had a really hard time. And so I think that if you can structure a book on proofs for high school students, I think it would be very valuable. And when it's published, I'd certainly be interested in talking to you about it.
Thank you. I'll try to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sasha. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.